Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
After graduating with honors in philosophy from Stanford University, Pamela Gullard worked as a waitress, a book critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, motel housekeeper, and editor for the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She now teaches literature at Menlo College. Award-winning writer Pamela Gullard grew up in Seattle with five siblings, reading novels, her father's medical journals, and Chekhov from her mother's small library. She says, "I still read anything. You never know where you'll learn something or find a poem that stops you cold." Pamela Gullard, welcome.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's not surprising that you and I like to read, but I wonder if the students who come to your classes are there because they like to read.
That's a very good question, and I love to ask them that. In fact, you must be a fly on the wall because that's the first question I ask. And I tell them the answer can be no, not in your life. So then I ask them, well, do you read any materials online about sports or whatever? And it turns out, oh, yeah, I read my grandmother's old recipes. And so we start having a conversation about the kinds of things that would intrigue you enough to read. And that's when I make my case for short stories.
Well, I've always liked to read, but I delayed taking my second literature class till pretty late in my coursework because I really didn't get it. I didn't know how to go about studying literature. And the professor would come in and he would lecture and he would tell us about the life of, say, Shelley. And so I wasn't getting it. So I went to his office to ask him, how do I study literature? He was no help at all. So I'm going to ask you, if I were to knock on your door and come to your office, what advice would you give me, Pamela?
I would be happy to give advice about that. And people ask me a similar type of question when I was a book critic at the Chronicle. And my literary friends would say, well, doesn't that ruin it for you because you are beginning to analyze right away? And I said, that's exactly it. I don't start analyzing. I read for work and I read for pleasure just about the same way, which is to let it flow through you first. You are already an analyzing machine about everything that you do, your work or your kids or whatever. And so that's not going to go away the second you start reading. So if at the very most when you're reading something, I think, if you feel just a little uptick, a little, oh, what about that? Or, oh, that makes me sad. Maybe put a tiny check in the text or highlight it in some way that you use on your computer. And then go back over those little tiny checks for your emotional journey for whatever you're reading, and you'll know an awful lot about the piece. So that's sort of step one as far as I'm concerned.
I think part of my problem is I was just too young to have had a background in reading a lot that I had anything to... I mean, I think about the books that were required reading when I was, say, a freshman. And if I would read them now, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it is I was just, maybe naive is the word. And you probably, some of your courses you teach at Menlo College are required courses. And so you're, I think, faced with the how to motivate these kids who are taking the course. Well, it's a requirement.
Right. Okay, so the first thing that I do is I had a long, hard think about this particular thing when I first created the course on analyzing short stories. And most people start out, like you say, with Shelley or not for short stories, but the older authors. My feeling is that our students are enmeshed in communications in the contemporary world. Why not bring in a story by Tobias Wolff, who happens to teach down the street and is a giant in American literature, and present them with a story called A Bullet in the Brain, which is what I do. And I think that if you can find that people have a little bit of success in looking at a short story, bringing what they have from their world, then they'll be able to analyze the story better. And after we do about a third of the semester on contemporary short stories, and people they may even have seen on talk shows or whatever, then we go back to some of the giants of American literature. In my case, it's American literature mostly. I teach some world literature. So I think that it's always good with any student. I mean, if you're teaching archery or if you're teaching pole vaulting, start with something they already know and then move on from there. And I will say some of the greatest pleasures in my life are when students come up to me and say, you know, before I took your course, I hated literature and I felt completely at sea. And now I feel like I have something to say.
Well, I didn't hate it, but I felt at sea. In fact, there's a professor here at Chico State University that has written collections of short stories, Rob Davidson, and he is so articulate about the process. I just wish, oh my gosh, I wish I could have taken his course when I was in college, and now I'm wishing, oh, I wish I could have taken your course, Pam.
Thank you.
My guest is Pamela Gullard, and she teaches at Menlo College. And she teaches literature. You also teach writing. I'm assuming you teach writing.
Personal narrative. I don't teach. I actually am not currently teaching creative writing. I have, but.
Well, here's a question that would not have come up not that long ago. You aren't faced then, if you're not really teaching writing, you're not faced with the problem of AI.
I am faced with the problem of AI. I feel as if what we're trying to do in college in general is make it possible for students to articulate their views based on something, whatever it may be. In personal narrative, it's based on their own life. In my short story analysis class, it's based on the story itself. And students, especially as the generations continue reeling on as they do, have less and less opportunity to use their own mind. So that's too blanket of a statement, but AI can do a lot for them that it would be better for them to do themselves, I believe. So last spring, I revamped my entire course, and almost all of it is done in class, do it on workshops. And so I'm lucky that I get to teach for 3 hours at a shot. So I teach a three-hour course once a week. And the students have to produce within that 3 hours a good analysis, usually with a group, of whatever it is that we're doing. So I'm very pleased with that format. I had used it largely in the past. The nice thing about teaching for a long time is that the students can, you know, groan about whatever it is that I'm telling them, I'm asking them to do. And I just say, well, that's what we're going to do. And they laugh and they go on and they do a good job often.
So do you get resistance of students saying, oh, I don't want to read Jane Eyre or some of the famous, that was so long ago, I can't relate to that. Do you get that resistance?
I do. And I, in some ways, I don't always love it, but often it's students who are genuinely curious, and I ask them to have a conversation either by email or in person and say, what is it that you think is not working for you? And let's have a conversation about it. I think I always tell them, your opinion is your opinion. If it's a choice of essay, if after they've given it two reads, they can choose a different short story to work on if they say, I honestly cannot bring anything to this. But usually I persuade them. I'm fairly persuasive.
My guest is Pamela Gullard, and she teaches English at Menlo College. And you started, your undergraduate degree is in philosophy. Oh, how did you happen to change the direction, if you did, in fact, of your studies?
Yes. Philosophy is known to be fairly dry, obviously, for good reason. But we did a lot of writing. And I think that most avenues in my life have gone through the door of writing. It always interested me to start with an argument and see if I could either amplify it or enrich it or discover for myself that what I had originally thought was completely wrong. And that's exactly, that's not exactly, obviously, but it's not unlike the drafts that you go through for fiction. So in fiction, I was thinking of an example this morning of a story where I knew that I was starting out thinking about a character who became disappointed in another character. And so I wrote a number of scenes. They didn't work. I wrote, I changed the setting. I changed a lot of things about the different characters. And then one day there were two characters together who I thought I was settled on, and something really violent happened. There was a house break-in. And that second, I knew that I had started out wrong, and I reversed it. And in that story, the story is now about somebody who's confronted with somebody else who's extremely disappointed in them. And I know that that may sound like a stretch, but that's very much like philosophy. You start out, you know, absolutely, this is right. I can prove it. Here it is. And you keep going until you think, no, wait a minute. I need to rethink this. So,
do you know,
so
what
it's
mine,
not a complete dance.
I have a couple of neighbors who they teach in the philosophy. And one of them was quite successful with the book because he brought humor to it. Because you just used the word dry for philosophy. And that's probably, or even in high school kids probably think that same thing. Or they'd even know, what is philosophy? And so I think if you can bring humor to your writing, that it'll be better received.
Almost in any case.
Yeah. So your students, do they, during the course of I think that students come to college and they should leave with a different view if they take a training, they could take a training somewhere, or they could get a job as a plumber or electrician. But it sounds like that students who take your class would come out of that class with a different view, a different understanding. Do you think that's the case?
I do hope so. I certainly do. And the first thing that I secretly always hope for is that they will eventually come to find some kind of literature that does work for them, that they would actually read for pleasure.
Yeah.
I guess that's the first thing. And then the other thing is, we think with AI that people are feeling more confident sometimes, but I think it erodes our confidence. And I had one student, I don't quite know exactly what she was saying by this, but she said, you ask me my opinion and you make me understand what it is that makes an opinion persuasive. Mm-hmm. And I love that, because I think that being able to have an analytical opinion also helps you, it increases the pleasure of any kind of reading you're doing, including fiction.
I totally agree. In fact, I happen to have taught as a graduate student, and my husband got a PhD, but he had a fellowship. He didn't really have to teach classes. And so he was asking me about how to teach, because he had just been lectured to. That's the way he was going to do it. And I said, let's reconsider that.
Right.
My guest is Pamela Gullard, and her book is Lake Crescent and Other Spirits. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Pamela Gullard, and she teaches literature at Menlo College. And she has also written a collection of stories. And the title is intriguing, Pam, Lake Crescent and Other Spirits. Now, I would think, other spirits? I would expect the word stories to be there. Lake Crescent is one of the short stories and other spirits.
And so as far as the title for it, Lake Crescent is a lake about as big as Tahoe that's on the Olympic Peninsula. And it's some place where I worked for a while when I was quite young. I was 20.
Yeah, I mentioned that you grew up in Seattle. Yeah.
Yes. So you can take a ferry. If you can see the cover of the book, it's got a drawing of a ferry on it.
Yes. And who drew that ferry, Pam?
Yes, I did. I drew the ferry. Yes, I love Seattle, and I love those ferries. And Lake Crescent has become dear to my heart. And I was alone when I worked at Lake Crescent. I worked at a national resort with some wonderful people. But then I went home to my little cabin, and I was one of the last college kids to come to that particular resort. And so I had the caretaker's cabin way out in the woods, and I am not the least bit courageous physically. And yet here I was all alone in this unheated cabin. It had a pot-bellied stove for wood, for fire. And I think there I really began to start feeling my own spirit of Pamness. It isn't somebody else's spirit, but who I was. If you're almost completely alone, you know, anytime when you're not working or going down to the lake, it's surprising what comes up. And I think I started to begin feeling like myself. And without even thinking about it, I just started filling notebooks with thoughts that I had about different things I could write. So.
And I appreciate the fact that you put the titles of your stories at the top of the page. So if I'm thumbing through or maybe I open at random, I can look at the top of the page and say, oh, that's what this story is about.
Yeah.
And the title story doesn't come till the very end. Lake Crescent is not until the end of your book. And it's the last story in your collection. And it's taking place, you've told us where the Lake Crescent is on the Olympic Peninsula. But I want to go back to an earlier story in your book, because the title is One Small Death Before the Plague. My goodness, Pamela, what do you mean by that?
Okay, so first of all, I have to tell you that friends and people in the audience in various places have teased me lightly about the fact that I could have cheerier titles. That's something that people have said.
Yeah.
So I understand that. So this story is about a guy who goes to play a tennis game, and he thinks he's just playing he's just out to have exercise and play and hopes to win and nothing more or less. And so that's where the small part of it comes. He had a death early in his family that he thought was small, and he begins to believe that it's something that has affected him greatly. And so I wanted to also, and the story was first published, I'm trying to think now where it was, in a literary magazine, and it was published just after COVID. So I wanted people to understand that there are other deaths that motivate us in ways that we maybe don't know. And so what I'm always looking for in my writing is these stories that hover under the surface of our lives. When we meet people, we tell stories, and sometimes they're true, as a friend of mine says, and we have stories about ourselves, things that we believe about ourselves. But sometimes there's almost a small death or a small event that has an enormous grip on us, but it's a secret grip that we don't see yet. And that's true for this main character, Jerry.
Well, you told us that the last story in your collection, Lake Crescent, you're familiar with Lake Crescent, you know it very well. And this story about a tennis game, you play tennis, Pam. And
I do, yeah.
You say that sometimes you outfox your tennis friends with your lefty spin. So when I'm reading this story about a tennis game, I know, yep, Pam plays tennis, so she knows what she's talking about.
Yeah.
But would you read us a little bit from this story, One Small Death Before the Plague?
I certainly will. And I think that, let me just make sure that we've covered the setup for this. So Jerry, who's our tennis player, he's a very strong amateur tennis player who doesn't belong to a club. If you play tennis, or especially in California, you may know of people who are brought on as substitutes. So if there's a club and they have a match and they're missing a player, they'll bring on one of these people who are pretty good players, then they're lightly associated with the club. But the important thing about that is that they don't know many other people. They just come in, play tennis, and leave. So that's true for Jerry. So I could start at the point where Jerry and his opponent have been kind of talking about the person whom Jerry is substituting for. Jerry is going to play in the place of this guy. And there's some kind of conversation that Jerry doesn't exactly understand. And his opponent says something about, well, it's really too bad. What happened to him? And Jerry's thinking, oh, my goodness, what happened to him? So that's where we'll start.
Okay.
So this is One Small Death Before the Plague, starting around the second or third page. So what happened to Luke? Usually it was just some kind of ankle injury or a rotator cuff, not enough to mention. Jerry looked at his opponent. Dropping dead just when your last kid's graduated college, what a deal. Dead? You never know. No longer on Earth? Jerry's chest tightened. The opponent sipped a cloudy blue power drink. He had another two bottles of it lined up on his side of the bench, Nadal style. He was in better shape than me, he said. The heart's a funny thing. I heard that he just had a physical and passed with flying colors. Crying shame. Cool sweat sprang up on Jerry's face, the backs of his hands. A strange acceleration rose through him. Playing for a dead man? Hard to know what to say. Yeah. The opponent headed to the service line and picked up the three balls at the tee. He quickly called the score and served an ace. Jerry hadn't been ready, but let it go. Some guys snuck in a few quick serves, and you looked like a whiner if you complained. Now he knew. A woman was sitting under a tree on the viewer's mound in the spot by the third table where Luke's wife usually sat. Had she been there all along? Luke's wife was often a quiet bystander who enjoyed the game but didn't play. Strange that she would come out alone so soon. The opponent served another ace out wide that Jerry couldn't come near. His feet were suddenly lead. She must have been in the sleepwalk state, hardly knowing what she was doing. She tilted her head, a faint movement Jerry caught out of the corner of his eye. The tree rattled its dark leaves above her, backlit from the entry light in the clubhouse, kept on 24/7 to discourage kids climbing the fence for a midnight swim. In the past, Jerry had barely noticed her, though once she'd handed him a beer after a match, and a light peppery scent had lingered for a moment. It was so faint he hadn't been sure if it was from food or perfume, more a shift in the air around her. She wasn't what she would call good-looking, but there was something. Lively, intelligent shifts of expression, the lift of her chin, her neck bare of jewelry. The opponent's next serve was too low, and this time Jerry got a racket on it, but the ball shot off into the next court, 40 love, before he'd blinked. Nice serve, Boyd, she called out from the little hill, her voice husky. Jerry looked directly at her, a small woman under a tree. Her grief so new and baffling that she was cheering for the wrong side. Well, at least she'd given him a name for his opponent, Boyd. Jerry got set. A surge of strength coursed through him. He sent a vicious return up the line that made Boyd stumble back as he scrambled for it. Then Jerry struck an easy put away. Ha! He glanced over at the widow in victory, ridiculously proud of himself, playing for her, the gladiator making her feel a little better. but she called out to encourage Boyd. Next time, wait, she was trying to cheer for the other guy? Two more hard-fought points and Jerry lost. Total score, 1-1. The woman clapped for Boyd.
This is award-winning writer Pamela Gullard, and she's reading from her collection of short stories. The name of that story was One Small Death Before the Plague, and the title of the collection of short stories, Lake Crescent and Other Spirits. Do you have anything else you would like to add, Pamela, that you think it would be helpful for us to know about this story or any of your stories in your book, or just as readers? There's so many people here in Chico that are writers. They have a writer's group here that support each other. And I just appreciate your passing along these great tips for writers.
Well, thank you. I guess I was just talking to somebody else this morning about a newish book group that I'm in, speaking of groups. And so I was in a book group for 25 years, and we couldn't stay together for various reasons. So this one is newish to me. And so what I have rediscovered, the pleasure of reading a book that I wouldn't choose myself. Mm-hmm. I have wonderful friends and acquaintances who give me tips, and I'm going to be even more dedicated to accepting their tips and reading the books they suggest, because you never know what a pleasure it's going to be.
I so totally agree with you. I remember a local writer approached me and told me he had a book, and so I asked him what it was about, and he said economics. And I thought, oh my gosh, speaking of dry. But my goodness, it was so fascinating. It wouldn't have been a book that I would have picked out on my own, but I was absolutely enthralled. So I think that's a really good point that you make. And so thank you so much for being a guest today, Pamela.
Thank you so much for having me here. This was a delightful conversation.
My guest has been award-winning writer Pamela Gullard and her collection of short stories, Lake Crescent and Other Spirits. After a break, I'll be talking to Kimberly Carlson Asara. She teaches at Shasta College, and her book is Unwrapping Christmas. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest also teaches writing to college students. Kimberly Carlson Asara has an MA from Humboldt State University in Literature and Writing and teaches English and Creative Writing at Shasta College. While she was writing her award-winning novel, Out of the Shadows, Kimberly Carlson Asara was an activist for Genocide No More, Save Darfur. They had a fundraiser to help the refugees. Through California Humanities, she was awarded a grant to help document stories from the car fire. Kimberly Asara has now a new book, Unwrapping Christmas. It's a story that holds hope as people search for community and love during the Christmas season. Kimberly Carlson Asara, welcome.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
You know, a few years ago, I interviewed you for your book, Out of the Shadows, but then you were just Kimberly Carlson. Now you have another last name.
Yes, Asara. I came across Asara. She was one of the first women philosophers and thinkers. She predates Socrates. She lived in Greece, what is now modern-day Italy. We only have fragments of her, what she wrote, but she wrote about bridging together mind, body, and spirit. And I just really admired her. And so I took on her last name. Asara is my daughter Anika's middle name.
My guest is Kimberly Carlson Asara, and she was just explaining the importance of the last name she now has. I also liked your author's note at the back of your book, and I might remind listeners that the title of this new book is Unwrapping Christmas, and I'd like you to read a couple of paragraphs from your author's note.
You bet. I started writing Unwrapping Christmas a few Christmases ago. Christmas time has always been something I looked forward to, a time when I could concentrate on family and beauty and music and the belief that miracles can and do happen. A time when people are generous and know that spreading love is what we all need to do. Christmas is a feast for all my senses, from hearing and singing Christmas carols, to eating chocolate, to the beautiful lights in my home, and the smell of pine tree that my son, daughter, and I cut down. It is said to write the book you want to read, and though I enjoy books set during the Christmas season, I felt there are not many books about the meaning of Christmas. So I set my pen to paper. How does the original Christmas story hold any meaning in our lives, lives that sometimes appear so different? But it is at Christmas when we chisel down what we all want: community, friendship, family, meaning, health, safety, and love.
This is my guest, Kimberly Carlson Asara, reading from her book. She has a new book, Unwrapping Christmas. And I really love that list of adjectives that you, or nouns that you have there, Kimberly. Community, friendship, family, meaning, health, safety, and love. And I noticed just in your dedication, the word love comes up three times.
Yes. As I said, when you chisel down Christmas or all the holidays, any holiday.
Thanksgiving.
Yes. That love is what we all seek. And it doesn't matter who we are, where we came from, what we are going through. That's what we're striving.
And you mentioned that you have two children, and it's not a surprise that's your dedication to your two children.
Yes, yes.
Well, in your book, how did you organize this book, Unwrapping Christmas?
So the idea came from the movie Love Actually. It's one of my favorite Christmas movies, and I loved all the different points of views and how all these people that from seemingly different walks of life, different, who are not, don't seem connected, actually are connected. And I thought how fun it would be to write a book about that, where there's a community and we first don't know how they're connected, but by the end of the book, we see that they're connected and we are all connected in our community.
And you have a lot of characters in your book.
I do.
Mm-hmm. My goodness.
Yes.
So you have organized these, a lot of different characters, and where is this all taking place?
It largely takes place in the Leavenworth, Washington area. And, some of the people live down in the Seattle area as well. I chose Leavenworth because it's just this beautiful, magical Bavarian city up in the Cascade Mountains. And, there is a feeling of I wanted to create like when you have a snow globe and you shake it and have that feeling of that magic of the snow falling down. And so Leavenworth was the perfect setting for that.
So you have all these various characters and you divide your book. You have a part one. You have several chapters. So you mentioned a cathedral there. And so Woodinville, Washington is a place, but I wondered, is that St. Mary's Cathedral a real cathedral? Because I thought maybe you made that up.
I did make that up. Yeah, I was just creating I wanted my first scene to be in during this magical, and music plays a huge part in this novel.
Yeah.
And the reason, the short chapters with the different, perspectives, I also, was wanting this book to be marketable. So I just know people don't have like lots of extra time during the Christmas season, but a 200-page book felt doable.
particularly since it's divided into short parts that
people
could read. And it's handy that you put at the top, like, say, chapter 3, and underneath the word 3 is the word Gabriel. So we know, oh, okay, that's who's going to be in this chapter. And then you flip over to another chapter, and you have maybe more than, some of your chapters have more than one name. But that's helpful for the reader to say, oh, okay, this is a chapter about Josiah and Ret.
Yes. Yes. So I wanted to be very clear of whose point of view that each chapter, you know, was about. Yes, that's how I did that.
Well, why don't you read us a little bit from, say, chapter 11.
Okay.
And we find out what Josiah and Ret have to say.
You bet. So Josiah and Ret. We have a forest full of trees. We don't need to cut one down and bring it into the house. Decorate that one or that one. His father was using the kitchen knife to point out the window at the trees outside. The smell of onions and garlic filled their small kitchen. I can't tell you how many tree stumps I found out in the woods cut incorrectly. I see tree stumps with as many as 6 saplings growing from one stump. Looks like something out of a science fiction movie. Trees grow sideways, under and through. I guess I should blow it off. They're all thriving, but it looks ridiculous, and it makes me mad. Of course, my favorite is when people cut a tree down and decide they like another one better and leave that one to rot. Josiah had Gabriel's dogs with him. Blitzen lay by the door, but Vixen walked around sniffing as if checking out the room for the first time. His tail was slamming into everything, and a table lamp almost fell off the end table.
And excuse me for interrupting, but you have these dogs named Blitzen and Vixen?
Yes. So a little backstory, Ret and Josiah are neighbors of Gabriel, and they're the only two houses on this road in the mountains. And Gabriel is away. He plays music. And so the 12-year-old boy, Josiah, watches Gabriel's dogs while he is away, and their names are Blitzen and Vixen. And, you know, as a writer, people always ask, are you writing about people you know about? And the answer is always no, except for these dogs. We growing up, we had 2 dogs named Blitzen and Vixen.
Named for the reindeer.
Yes.
In the Christmas story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So Blitzen and Vixen were modeled after real dogs.
Yes, they were. Yes.
Okay. So now, Dad.
So continue, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes you make no sense, Dad. Let's do this for Mom, but not this. Let's kill this deer, but not this tree. And though Josiah was young, there was a truth to what he said. From the outside, his dad didn't make sense. But what Josiah hadn't learned was that almost everything his father did was done thoughtfully. When, what he hunted and when, what he cut and when, which memories he preserved of his wife, and which ones he chose not to. But Josiah was correct about his Christmas memories. They did have a Christmas tree when April was alive. Each year, a huge, perfectly decorated tree that sent pine fragrance throughout the house. They'd sip hot cocoa, and sometimes Ret would kiss her, and she'd kiss him. One perfect night, they made love by the fire and Christmas tree, and he recalled that night being the best night of his life, the night his son was conceived. There would be no more perfect nights, not like that one. Ret knew he was being hard on his son, thinking he was teaching him some lesson that life sucks. We can lose the ones we love. There is no forever, Josiah. Everything dies. Tears appeared in his eyes. He wiped them quickly away with his flannel shirt cuff. I hate cutting down trees, he said. Blitzen stood and rubbed his nose into Ret's leg. Ret bent and gave the dog a 2-handed scratch behind its ears. We can buy one, Josiah said, concentrating on his Legos. He didn't see his dad's tears. I hate cutting the onions, his dad added. You didn't even buy us one from Costco with the lights already on. You mean a fake tree? A plastic tree? Well, yeah, why not? It smells nothing like a tree, and who doesn't love the smell of plastic? The sky was turning a deep pink and purple. Ret shook his head. Son, time to take the dogs home. I bought pie for Christmas Eve. Pumpkin, your favorite. Suddenly, Josiah swept his arm across the table. the Lego airplane he had been working on for days, with all the tiny, expensive plastic pieces, went flying across the room. Blitzen lifted his head in full alert, watching son and then father. Vixen strolled over and sniffed the broken Lego airplane, licking each piece in hopes that there was a morsel of food to be found. "Pick that up. You said take the dogs." Josiah's voice was icy and defiant. "Now I'm saying pick that up." Josiah grabbed the big pieces of the flight deck and the propellers and tossed them back onto the table. By the front door, he slipped on his coat. "Come on, boys, let's go home."
This is my guest. She teaches at Shasta College. Her name is Kimberly Carlson Isara, and she's reading from her new book, Unwrapping Christmas. And now that chapter ends on kind of an unhappy note.
Yes, and that's when, the father is dealing with the loss of his wife, as the son is. But instead of coming together at this point in the story, they're pushing each other apart. And that's when Josiah takes the dogs. He was planning on taking the dogs home, but one of the dogs takes off running into the snowy woods, and Josiah goes after it.
And I personally have a fondness for Christmas Day, because it was on Christmas Eve that I became a widow. My husband died Christmas Eve, and the next day was so beautiful and quiet. And so this father is upset because of losing his wife, but he takes it out on his son?
Yeah, not purposefully. And like a lot of times we don't, you know, he's trying to do the best he can, but he's dealing with his own pain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's doing many of the right things, cooking dinner, buying pie, he's home. But
because he says, pumpkin's your favorite pie. Yeah. I've bought pie for Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Your favorite.
But the memories of his wife is clouding his relationship with his relationship with his son.
So I think your book is encouraging understanding of what other people are going through.
That was my purpose, is as, you know, every character is diverse, like we all are. We all are suffering, and we all have our trials that we're living through every single day. And but it's through people and relationship and love and hope and forgiveness that brings us together.
And, you know, I'm sure you've probably heard, too, that writing can be therapeutic. Even if you just write it for yourself and nobody else ever sees it, it's helpful to put down your feelings and thoughts and write them down. And I think people listening to what you have to say, Kimberly, will think, you know, I'd never want to publish a book, but maybe I should write down my memoir for my family. So what tips do you have for people who maybe they like to read but never thought, well, I'm not a writer?
Right. So reading is the first step. I always tell, you know, and if you want to be a writer, you need to read. The other thing, I think, because writing is very difficult, I think sometimes people think that writers think writing is easy. And I think actually that's not the case. We know how difficult it is. So for me, it's always creating a discipline. And I, you know, I won't say every day, but most every day I wake up and I write first thing for a couple hours. And maybe in the evening I might go back and revise it. But so I always tell people to just create a time of the day that works for you and stick with it. And just, never to edit the first time around, always just to get all your thoughts and feelings and ideas down, and you can always come back to it later.
I think that's true of anything. If you're writing prose or poetry or a song, I think that would be, if you're hearing something in your head and you get it down on paper, it may not be perfect. And you do mention music. You say it's during revisions, so get it down, you recommend that. During revisions that we add depth, character, motives, and music to our work, just like a piece of art. And so I think, yeah, music. And I've noticed throughout history there will be, when there's a movement, the Renaissance or whatever it is, that it often includes writing, literature, art, paintings. And so I like the fact that you say during that revision, you can add music to your work.
Right. And I just, because I think of like the motives and the themes, like in music. And so it is during the revision that you can add, I just think you're adding those final touches. I mean, I reread my stuff sometimes hundreds of times, depending on what passage or what I'm working on. And I read it out loud. Actually, it was Steinbeck who used to say, you have to read out loud, especially dialogue. You have to read out loud. But even my visuals, it's language. I want it to sound, whatever I'm describing, you want it to sound like that, what you're feeling.
Well, that's why I'm such a slow reader, because if I'm sitting at home, I'm not necessarily reading out loud, but I'm reading dialogue at the pace it would be spoken. So I'm a slow reader because I like to, even if it's just in my head, hear the dialogue that these characters, what they're saying. And you're saying that, read it out loud.
Yes, especially as writers, you should read it out loud so you can kind of get a sense of maybe how your readers are hearing it. When you're writing, you can be so close to your work, and of course, always let other people read it as well, which takes a lot of bravery. But
yeah,
just to get someone else's perspective. I do read my work out loud.
In fact, we have a group here, North State Writers, that they get together and support each other and offer tips to each other. So how do your students, react? Oh, Ms. Azara, I don't know if I could do that. Did they resist some of your recommendations that you were just giving us?
Oh, yes. I always start with reading something great. No matter what I'm teaching, I just think that, and if they see my passion with it, and I'll point out some really, beautiful things, and when I say beauty, I'm not always talking about perfection, I think literature is, beauty is finding life in our suffering and the things we need to grow and change. So start with reading, and then, I assure them that each student has their own story. No one else has their story. And to give them a lot of, confidence in that you are the only person who could tell their story. Nobody else can tell their story. And that's, so it's a lot of it is confidence that you do have something to say. And then within my classroom, I do create that community, as that word comes up again. But yeah.
Well, I think people will be inspired. Maybe they will take up pen and paper themselves, Kimberly. My guest has been Kimberly Carlson Azara. She teaches writing and literature at Shasta College in Reading, and she has a new novel, Unwrapping Christmas. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Pamela Gullard, whose book is Lake Crescent and Other Spirits. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The name of this piece is Dog Food. I woke up Monday morning to the realization that I was out of dog food and cold brew coffee. Dang it. For most people, that coffee is a morning treat that helps them get their day started. For me, it's a daily vaccine that keeps away the viral tsunami of cranky that threatens to overwhelm my peaceful transition to the awake world. Not sure about your furry family members, but my Bella can tell time. Her meal times may be 7:30 a.m. and 3:30 p.m., but at 7 and 3, she attaches herself to me like Velcro and gives me that I am starving and about to die look that melts my heart like the chocolate bar I left on the dash of my car. Knowing that Costco doesn't open for a couple of hours, I scrounge around the fridge and find some old K-cups and enough dog treats to keep Bella from passing out. Okay, now we wait. Time is funny when you're impatiently waiting for something to happen. Bella's looking at me like maybe I'm edible, and I'm barely holding off the tsunami while the minutes seem to take hours. Finally, it's 10 minutes to opening time. It takes me 9.5 minutes to drive to Costco, so I'm figuring I can rush through the front door just as they pull it up, heading straight for the pallet with the cold brew coffee. It was a good plan, except they moved it. I spot a Costco employee and start towards him as he backs away from the crazy-looking guy coming at him. I manage to squeak out, "Where's the cold brew?" He visibly relaxes as he now understands the problem, so instead of just giving me directions, he walks me to the aisle with the stash, the coffee. Okay, coffee and dog food in hand, I head to the car. Bella's waiting with that, "How could you possibly run out of dog food?" look, so I open a can and feed her on the spot. I then open a can of cold brew and enjoy the moment like an addict getting his fix. Everything is now good until Bella decides to pay me back for my forgetfulness by letting out a giant dog fart. I'm pretty sure I heard her giggle as I dove out the car door. Brad Johnson.
I do not write for the answers, though I'd like to have them. I write for truth. And the truth is, the world goes on without asking what I need from it. I don't need to give it the language it already speaks, nor do I need to solve the grand mystery as much as I try to. Still, there is an insatiable ache within me to understand, to be understood, that in writing it all down, it will somehow enchant the enigma into meaning something, that a single late-night sentence might land differently, the "ah, this right here" kind of prose that suddenly makes it all feel more digestible, more bearable, more true. And maybe in some small way it does. But I'm learning that perhaps the need to understand is not the point, that the power is in the inquiry, in the ache itself, the space between the pen and the paper, in the noticing. Maybe the unspoken knows more than I do. Maybe truth lives not in the answer, but in the question. Not in the emptiness, but in the overflow. Kelly Lieberman.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.